From PRI, Public Radio International.
America, to me, should be shouting all the time. A bunch of shouting voices. Most of them wrong, some of them nuts, but please, not just one droning, glamorous, reasonable voice.
That was Harris Yulin reading an excerpt from George Saunders' story, My Flamboyant Grandson, which you'll hear a bit later in this program. This is Selected Shorts, a celebration of the short story. And I'm Isaiah Sheffer, Artistic Director of Symphony Space, a theater in Uptown Manhattan, where Selected Shorts originates. The readings on this broadcast edition of the show are from a Symphony Space evening that was selected and hosted by the graphic novelist Art Spiegelman and his wife Françoise Mouly, art editor of The New Yorker and inspirer of many of its most admired cover designs. Their first choice was a nonfiction account by a North Borneo animal trainer, Saudin Bin Labutau, about his visit to New York, a story they later published in their magazine, Raw. It's entitled Aborigine Among the Skyscrapers. The reader is the actor and composer Michael Keck.
I was so astonished by New York that I just wanted to look and look and look at it. I forgot all about feeding the animals and my work. Every night, men had their names put in the sky with bright lights so that they would not be forgotten, because there are so many people in New York that it would be easy to forget some of them. All the time, there was great noise made by motor cars and buses and trains. There were trains above me on bridges. There were trains below me. And there were more trains that were below the trains that were below. Always, the trains were very full of people. I think the trains all stopped and the people got off of them, there would be no space in New York for all the people. So the people take turns living in the trains. I used to walk and walk because I was afraid to get on those trains to ride, as I did not know how to get off or where I should be when I did, or if I might have to live on one. The streets were very clean. They washed and polished them every morning. I thought there could be no sickness there with everything so clean. The buildings were very tall. Sometimes I had to go up and down in what men called an elevator. This is a little room that you get into, and very suddenly it goes up, and when it stops, your stomach does not stop. And when it goes down, you feel that everything is gone out of you. It is much worse than an airplane. I was always afraid in it, but said nothing, because I thought men would say, "He's just a jungle man." In winter, there is a very cold climate in New York. Often I shivered and was cold, although I wore many clothes and my handsome black coat. All men wore heavy clothes and coats like mine, which hung down to their knees. But truly, I was astonished at the women. They did not wear many clothes except around their necks, where they wore the skins of animals. They wore very little under this, because the wind would show me. Their stockings were just like nothing. Truly, I was astonished that they did not feel cold. In New York, we put Mr. Johnson's animals in Central Park Zoo, and I went there every day to take care of them. At first, Mr. Johnson went with me so that I would not be lost, and later I could go alone. But I was always afraid of the motor cars. I walked a great deal up and down the same street and never far away, as I was afraid of being lost. At night, I did not go away at all, because when the lights were in the sky, all things became different, and I was confused. One day he told me to go to the cinema. When I went in, it was daylight. But when I came out, it was dark. It was only 5 o'clock, and in my country, that was still daytime. But in New York, in winter, that's nighttime, and the lights are on. When I looked up, I could see nothing but very tall buildings and a red glow at the top of the buildings and no sky. All the men were hurrying from here to there. All the trains made noises and all the lights blinked, and I became confused. I walked and walked, but I could not find a place where I lived. Mr. Johnson had written a letter for me telling who I was and where I lived in case I should be lost someday. And as I was lost then, I looked in my coat and was much astonished to find that the letter was lost also. I went to a policeman and asked him how to get to Central Park Zoo, because if I could find that, I could find my house, which was near it. The policeman said it was 12 blocks away, so I said, "Thank you very much," and walked on some more. Then I asked another policeman, and he said, 9 blocks farther. And I walked some more. But the next policeman I asked said, "Here is Central Park Zoo." And there I was at the zoo. But I did not recognize it with the lights on. So then I found my house, which I think was very good fortune because I had indeed been lost. One day, the newspaper men came to talk to me, and they said, "Do you like New York? What do you like the best?" And I said, "Yes, I like New York, and I like best the red electric light signs that run like streams of fire and the lights that chase each other around like small animals." One day I was out walking, and I came to a large place with many horses in it. And I said to the man with a uniform, "Can I enter?" And he said, "You must buy a ticket." I said, "I will buy a ticket. Now, can I enter?" And he said, "Sure." So I entered and saw large, wonderful horses and handsome men with beautiful colored uniforms. They played music, and the horses danced to the music. I think the horses in New York are smarter than all the policemen in my country. So I struck my hands together the way the other people did, with astonishment and joy. When the playing was finished, all the people wanted to leave at once in a great hurry, and everybody pushed everybody, and I fell down. A man picked me up, and I said, "Thank you very much," and went home. I went to see boxing and wrestling. Boxing is all right, but wrestling is too rough. In my country, we do not act like that unless we wish to kill men. One day, a man fell down in the streets and lay there wounded. Everybody just looked at him and walked on. So I looked at him and walked on too, because I was afraid that if I stayed near him, people would think that I wounded him. Afterwards, I told Mr. Johnson, and he said, "People get killed here every day." I was walking one day and met a man who was drunk, the same man as a man in Borneo when he drinks too much rice beer. The man said, "You are Filipino, like me." I said, "No, I am a Malay." He said, No, "You are Filipino." I said, "You are drunk. You had better go home. Don't you know people get killed here every day?" But he didn't go home, and he wanted to fight me because I wasn't a Filipino. So I ran and stood by an important man in a uniform who stood at the door of a hotel. I stood very close to this important man, and as he wouldn't let the drunken Filipino come to the hotel, he couldn't fight me. Mr. Johnson took me to a place where you put money in a hole and take out a plate of food. The different holes have names on them to tell you what foods are concealed within. We had vegetables and potato and meat all cooked together in a flour wrapping which they call a pie. I think this place is very cunning indeed, because the hole to receive a 10-cent piece was so small that you could not put in a 5-cent piece. One time a man gave me some wine to drink. I drank a little, and then I remembered about the many motor cars and trains outside, the great noise and confusion, and the people who got killed there every day. And I was afraid I might be hit, lost, or killed if I drank anymore. So I didn't drink anymore. Mr. Jim, who used to drive the flying ship in Borneo, was in New York too, but he did not live there. One day we flew from New York to his home in a very large flying ship, much larger than Mr. Johnson's, with many people in it. I was not afraid because I was used to flying before, but it was very different from flying over Borneo. In my country, I looked down on jungle trees and rivers of which I'm not afraid. But here, I looked down on buildings and trains, which would be difficult to fall upon in comfort. In New York, there was snow and ice on the wings of the flying ship. It was very rough weather, the same as on our boat before coming to Cape Town, and I was sick, but I did not vomit. We went many miles before coming to Mr. Jim's village, but I do not remember the name of this village. We went into his house, and his people gave us food and drink, but I was ashamed to eat with them because I did not know how to eat the food cleverly as they did. Because all my life in my country, I was accustomed to eat with my fingers. It was difficult to carry the food with those small weapons to my mouth. I did not wish to be rude by not eating the food after their custom, so I pretended I was not very hungry and went to bed soon. The next day, we returned to New York. One day, Mr. Johnson said to me that in 2 days, he must put me on a ship to return to Borneo. I was very sad to hear this because he was very good to me, and America was so astonishing. I cried like a child, and I couldn't eat anything. First, I thought I'd stay in America and work. But the next day, I thought, well, never mind. If he says I must go, I will go. Now I will go back to my village and see my people. I will buy more buffaloes and plant more rice. When the harvest season comes, I will harvest my rice, and I will drink rice beer and take a wife. But although I will live as all men do here, never will I forget America.
Michael Keck read An Aborigine Among the Skyscrapers by Saudin Bin Labuto. The next story, Philip K. Dick's wonderful Beyond Lies the Wub, a science fiction gem, was introduced on stage by Art Spiegelman and Francoise Mouly.
Now, what Phil has said about his own writing is, science fiction writers, I'm sorry to say, really do not know anything. We can't talk about science because our knowledge of it is limited and unofficial, and usually our fiction is dreadful. And in a way, like whenever I've tried to talk about Phil Dick with some writers that I know, they're always a little bit dismissive because he wasn't a good writer, sentence to sentence, but what he was a great philosopher. And if you ever tried to read philosophers like Heidegger or Derrida, you find out he's also a great writer in comparison to them. A model of clarity. But basically, what he was able to do from his very earliest fiction throughout was deal with really thorny subjects, like what is reality? And he said, reality is that which, when you stop believing in it, doesn't go away. And then talking about what it is to be human, which is the subject of the story you'll be hearing tonight. And he says, it's not what you look like or what planet you were born on, it's how kind you are. The quality of kindness to me distinguishes us from rocks and sticks and metal and will forever, whatever shape we take, wherever we go, whatever we become. So what you'll hear now is the very first story Philip Dick published, which was in a 1952 issue of Planet magazine, which was the most lurid and lowly of the pulp magazines that still existed in the 50s. And it'll be read to you by Dennis O'Hare. Thanks.
They had almost finished with the loading. Outside stood the Optus, his arms folded, his face sunk in gloom. Captain Franco walked leisurely down the gangplank, grinning. "What's the matter?" he said. "You're getting paid for all this." The Optus said nothing. He turned away, collecting his robes. The captain put his boot on the hem of the robe. "Just a minute. Don't go off. I'm not finished." "Oh?" The Optus turned with dignity. "I am going back to the village." He looked toward the animals and birds being driven up the gangplank into the spaceship. "I must organize new hunts." Franco lit a cigarette. "Why not? You people can go out into the veldt and track it all down again. But when we run halfway between Mars and Earth..." The Optus went off, wordless. Franco joined the first mate at the bottom of the gangplank. "How's it coming?" he said. He looked at his watch. "We got a good bargain here." The mate glanced at him sourly. "How do you explain that?" "What's the matter with you? We need it more than they do." "I'll see you later, Captain." The mate threaded his way up the plank between the long-legged Martian go-birds into the ship. Franco watched him disappear. He was just starting up after him, up the plank toward the port, when he saw it. "My God!" He stood staring, his hands on his hips. Peterson was walking along the path, his face red, leading it by a string. "I'm sorry, Captain," he said, tugging at the string. Franco walked toward him. "What is it?" The wub stood sagging, its great body settling slowly. It was sitting down, its eyes half shut. A few flies buzzed about its flank, and it switched its tail. It sat. There was silence. "It's a wub," Peterson said. "I got it from a native for 50 cents. He said it was a very unusual animal, very respected." "This?" Franco poked the great sloping side of the wub. "It's a pig. A huge, dirty pig." "Yes, sir, it's a pig. The natives call it a wub." "A huge pig. It must weigh 400 pounds. Franco grabbed a tuft of the rough hair. The wub gasped. Its eyes opened, small and moist. Then its great mouth twitched. A tear rolled down the wub's cheek and splashed on the ground. "Maybe it's good to eat," Peterson said nervously. "We'll soon find out," Franco said. The wub survived the takeoff, sound asleep in the hold of the ship. When they were out in space and everything was running smoothly, Captain Franco bade his men fetch the wub upstairs so that he might perceive what manner of beast it was. The wub grunted and wheezed, squeezing up the passageway. "Come on," Jones grated, pulling at the rope. The wub twisted, rubbing its skin off on the smooth chrome walls. It burst into the anteroom, tumbling down in a heap. The men leaped up. "Good Lord," French said. "What is it?" "Peterson says it's a wub," Jones said. "It belongs to him." He kicked at the wub. The wub stood up, unsteadily, panting. "What's the matter with it?" French came over. "Is it going to be sick?" They watched. The wub rolled its eyes mournfully. It gazed around at the men. "I think it's thirsty," Peterson said. He went to get some water. French shook his head. "No wonder we had so much trouble taking off. I had to reset all my ballast calculations." Peterson came back with the water. The wub began to lap gratefully, splashing the men. Captain Franco appeared at the door. "Let's have a look at it." He advanced, squinting critically. "You got this for 50 cents? "Yes, sir," Peterson said. "It eats almost anything. I fed it on grain, and it liked that, and then potatoes and mash and scraps from the table, and milk. It seems to enjoy eating. After it eats, it lies down and goes to sleep." "I see," Franco said. "Now, as to its taste, that's the real question. I doubt if there's much point in fattening it up any more. It seems fat enough to me already. Where's the cook? I want him here. I want to find out..." The wub stopped lapping and looked up at the captain. "Really, Captain," the wub said, "I suggest we talk of other matters." The room was silent. "What was that?" Franco said. "Who spoke just now?"
"The wub, sir," Peterson said. "It spoke."
They all looked at the wub. "What did it say? What did it say?"
"It suggested we talk about other things."
Franco walked toward the wub. He went all around it, examining it from every side. Then he came back over and stood with his men. "I wonder if there's a native inside it," he said thoughtfully. "Maybe we should open it up and have a look." "Oh, goodness," the wub cried. "Is that all you people can think of? Killing and cutting?" Franco clenched his fists. "Come out of there! Whoever you are, come out!" Nothing stirred. The men stood together, their faces blank, staring at the wub. The wub swished its tail. It belched suddenly.
"I beg your pardon,"
the wub said.
"I don't think there's anyone in there,"
Jones said in a low voice. They all looked at each other. The cook came in. "You wanted me, Captain?" he said. "What's this thing?" "This is a wub," Franco said. "It's to be eaten. Will you measure it and figure it out?"
"I think we should have a talk,"
the wub said. "I'd like to discuss this with you, Captain, if I might. I can see that you and I do not agree on some basic issues." The captain took a long time to answer. The wub waited good-naturedly, licking the water from its jowls. "Come into my office," the captain said at last. He turned and walked out of the room. The wub rose and paddled after him. The men watched it go out. They heard it climbing the stairs.
"I wonder what the outcome will be," the cook said.
"Well, I'll be in the kitchen. Let me know as soon as you hear."
"Sure," Jones said. "Sure."
The wub eased itself down in the corner with a sigh. "You must forgive me," it said. "I'm afraid I'm addicted to various forms of relaxation when one is as large as I." The captain nodded impatiently. He sat down at his desk and folded his hands. "All right," he said. "Let's get started." "You're a wub? Is that correct?" The wub shrugged. "I suppose so. That's what they call us, the natives, I mean. We have our own term." "And you speak English? You've been in contact with Earthmen before?"
"No."
"Then how do you do it?"
"Speak English." "Am I speaking English?"
"I'm not conscious of speaking anything in particular. I examined your mind."
"My mind?"
"I studied the contents, especially the semantic warehouse, as I refer to it."
"I see,"
the captain said. "Telepathy, of course." "We are a very old race," the wub said. "Very old and very ponderous. It is difficult for us to move around. You can appreciate that anything so slow and heavy would be at the mercy of more agile forms of life. There'd be no use in our relying on physical defenses. How could we win? Too heavy to run, too soft to fight, too good-natured to hunt for game."
"How do you live?"
"Plants? Vegetables? We can eat almost anything. We're very Catholic." "Tolerant, eclectic, Catholic. We live and let live. That's how we've gotten along." The wub eyed the captain. "And that's why I so violently objected to this business about having me boiled. I could see the image in your mind, most of me in the frozen food locker, some of me in the kettle, a bit for your pet cat. So you read minds, the captain said. How interesting. Anything else? I mean, what else can you do along those lines? A few odds and ends, said the wub absently, staring around the room. A nice apartment you have here, Captain. You keep it quite neat. I respect life forms that are tidy. Some Martian birds are quite tidy. They throw things out of their nests and sweep them. Indeed, the captain nodded. But to get back to the problem, quite so. You spoke of dining on me. The taste, I am told, is good, a little fatty but tender. But how can any lasting contact be established between your people and mine if you resort to such barbaric attitudes? Eat me? Rather, you should discuss questions with me. Philosophy. The arts. The captain stood up. Philosophy. It might interest you to know that we'll be hard put to fight something to eat for the next month. An unfortunate spoilage. I know. The wub nodded. But wouldn't it be more in accord with your principles of democracy if we all drew straws, or something along that line? After all, democracy is to protect the minority from such infringements. Now, if each of us casts one vote... The captain walked to the door. Nuts to you, he said. He opened the door. He opened his mouth. He stood frozen, his mouth wide, his eyes staring, his fingers still on the knob. The wub watched him. Presently, it padded out of the room, edging past the captain. It went down the hall, deep in meditation. The room was quiet. So you see, the wub said, we have a common mind, myth. Your mind contains many familiar myth symbols. Ishtar, Odysseus. Peterson sat silently staring at the floor. He shifted in his chair. Go on, he said. Please, go on. I find in your Odysseus a figure common to my mythology of most self-conscious races. As I interpret it, Odysseus wanders as an individual, aware of himself as such. This is the idea of separation. Of separation from family and country, the process of individuation. But Odysseus returns to his home. Peterson looked out the port window at the stars, endless stars, burning intently in the empty universe. Finally, he goes home, as must all creatures. The moment of separation is a temporary period, a brief journey of the soul. It begins, it ends. The wanderer returns to land and race. The door opened. The wub stopped, turning his great head. Captain Franco came into the room, the men behind him. They hesitated at the door. Are you all right? French said. Do you mean me? Peterson said, surprised. Why me? Franco lowered his gun. Come over here, he said to Peterson. Get up. Come here. There was silence.
Go ahead, said the wub. It doesn't matter.
Peterson stood up.
What for?
It's an order. Peterson walked to the door. French caught his arm. What's going on? Peterson wrenched loose. What's the matter with you? Captain Franco moved toward the wub. The wub looked up from where it lay in the corner, pressed against the wall. It is interesting, the wub said, that you are obsessed with the idea of eating me. I wonder why. Get up. Franco said. If you wish. The wub rose, grunting. Be patient. It is difficult for me. It stood, gasping, its tongue lolling foolishly. Shoot it now, French said. For God's sake, Peterson exclaimed. Jones turned to him quickly, his eyes gray with fear. You didn't see him, like a statue, standing there, his mouth open. If we hadn't come down, he'd still be there. Who? The captain? Peterson stared around. But he's all right now. They looked at the wub, standing in the middle of the room, its great chest rising and falling. Come on, Franco said. Out of the way. The men pulled aside toward the door. You are quite afraid, aren't you? Said the wub. Have I done anything to you? I am against the idea of hurting. All I have done is try to protect myself. Can you expect me to rush eagerly to my death? I am a sensible being like yourselves. I was curious to see your ship, learn about you. I suggested to the native. The gun jerked. See? Franco said. I thought so. The wub settled down, panting. It put its paw out, pulling its tail around it. It is very warm, the wub said. I understand that we are close to the jets. Atomic power. You have done many wonderful things with it, technically. Apparently, your scientific hierarchy is not equipped to solve the moral, ethical. Franco turned to his men, crowding behind him, wide-eyed silent. I'll do it. You can watch. French nodded. Try to hit the brain. It's no good for eating. Don't hit the chest. If the ribcage shatter, we'll have to pick the bones out. Listen, Peterson said, licking his lips. Has it done anything? What harm has it done? I'm asking you. And anyhow, it's still mine. You have no right to shoot it. It doesn't belong to you. Franco raised his gun. I'm going out, Jones said, his face white and sick. I don't want to see it. Me too, French said. The men straggled out, murmuring. Peterson lingered at the door. It was talking to me about myths, he said. It wouldn't hurt anyone. He went outside. Franco walked toward the wub. The wub looked up slowly. It swallowed. A very foolish thing, it said. I'm sorry that you want to do it. There was a parable that your savior related. It stopped, staring at the gun. Can you look me in the eye and do it? The wub said. Can you do that? The captain gazed down. I can look you in the eye, he said. Back on the farm, we had hogs, dirty razorback hogs. I can do it. Staring down at the wub, into the gleaming, moist eyes, he pressed the trigger. The taste was excellent. They sat glumly around the table, some of them hardly eating at all. The only one who seemed to be enjoying himself was Captain Franco. More? He said, looking around. More? And some wine, perhaps? Not me, French said. I think I'll go back to the chart room. Me too. Jones stood up, pushing his chair back. I'll see you later. The captain watched them go. Some of the others excused themselves. What do you suppose the matter is? The captain said. He turned to Peterson. Peterson sat staring down at his plate, at the potatoes, the green peas, and at the thick slab of tender, warm meat. He opened his mouth. No sound came. The captain put his hand on Peterson's shoulder. It is only organic matter now, he said. The life essence is gone. He ate, spooning up the gravy with some bread. I myself love to eat. It is one of the greatest things that a living creature can enjoy. Eating, resting, meditation. Discussing things. Peterson nodded. Two more men got up and went out. The captain drank some water inside. Well, he said, I must say that this was a very enjoyable meal. All the reports I have heard were quite true. A taste of wub. Very fine, but I was prevented from enjoying this in times past. He dabbed at his lips with his napkin and leaned back in his chair. Peterson stared dejectedly at the table. The captain watched him intently. He leaned over. Come, come, he said. Cheer up. Let's discuss things. He smiled. As I was saying before I was interrupted, the role of Odysseus in the myths... Peterson jerked up, staring. To go on, the captain said. Odysseus, as I understand him...
The That was Philip K. Dick's Beyond Lies the Wub. Don't you just love wubs, especially erudite wubs? It was read to us by Dennis O'Hare, who confessed that he's a great fan of Philip K. Dick's work. After a brief break, we'll hear another fantasy by George Saunders, read by Harris Yulin. You are listening to Selected Shorts, recorded live in performance at Symphony Space in New York City and at other venues nationwide, from PRI, Public Radio International. Welcome back to Selected Shorts, recorded live at Symphony Space in New York City. Symphony Space's season is sponsored by Zabar's, offering the nation a taste of New York. Coffee, gourmet foods, and gift baskets available online at zabars.com. Here now is our final story, My Flamboyant Grandson by George Saunders, introduced from the stage of Symphony Space by Art Spiegelman and Francoise Mouly.
The story by George Saunders really was wild because it seemed like he had inherited Philip K. Dick's legacy, mixed it with a little bit of Robert Coover and Franz Kafka and whatever.
Didn't Saunders tell you that he hadn't
He just inherited the legacy. He didn't know Phil Dick's writing. But that dystopic future that Phil Dick had really accurately predicted was the starting off point for most of George Saunders' story. The only difference is that George Saunders is really good at sentences. He can write them. And, in fact, I found this thing he wrote called The Battle for Precision in The Guardian from about a year ago. And he wrote, "When I was a child, I mostly disliked writers and writing in our English textbook, which had one of those 70s titles that connoted nothing, Issues and Perspectives, maybe, or Amalgam 109. The sentences were lazy and everyday, emanating from what I have since heard called consensus reality. These sentences seem to emanate from no person and to argue against the intimate actual feeling of minute-to-minute life." Then after quoting a horrible example of bureaucratic language that turns out to be a description of loading up the ovens in Auschwitz, describing the people as loads, he then goes on to say that specificity, precision, and brevity applied to language drives us toward compassion. So this story, My Flamboyant Grandson, which is the one that introduced me to him, is in his upcoming book of stories, In Persuasion Nation. It's amusing, appalling, but above all, empathic, despite its blackness. And therefore, I encourage you to do what Selected Shorts encourages in general, which is listen to the sentences. And this will be read to you by Harris Yulin. Thanks for bearing with us.
Thank you.
I had brought my grandson to New York to see a show because what is he always doing up here in Oneonta? Singing and dancing. Sometimes to my old show tune records, but more often than not to his favorite CD, Babar Sings. Sometimes even making up his own steps, which I do not mind, or rather I try not to mind it. Although I admit that once, coming into his room and finding him wearing a pink boa while singing, in the voice of the old lady, "I have never met a man like that elephant," I had to walk out and give it some deep thought and prayer, as was also the case when he lumbered into the parlor during a recent church couple's dinner, singing "Big and Slow, Yet So Very Regal," wearing a tablecloth spray-painted gray so as to more closely resemble Babar. Being a man who knows something about grandfatherly disapproval, having had a grandfather who constantly taunted me for having enlarged calves to the extent that even today, while bathing, I find myself thinking unkind thoughts about Grandfather. What I prayed on both occasions was, "Dear Lord, he is what he is. Let me love him no matter what. If he's a gay child, God bless him. If he is a non-gay child who simply very much enjoys wearing his grandmother's wig while singing Edelweiss to the dog, so be it. And in either case, let me communicate my love and acceptance in everything I do. Because where is a child to go for unconditional love if not to his grandfather? He has had it tough, in my view, with his mother in Nevada and a father unknown, raised by his grandmother and me in an otherwise childless neighborhood, playing alone in a tiny yard that ends in a graveyard wall. The boys in his school are hard on him, as are the girls, as are his teachers. And recently we found his book bag in the Susquehanna. And recently also found, taped to the back of his jacket, a derogatory note, and the writing on it was not all that childish looking. And there were rumors that his bus driver had written it. Then one day I had a revelation. If the lad likes to sing and dance, I thought, why not expose him to the finest singing and dancing there is? So I called 1-800-CULTURE, got our promissory voucher in the mail, and on Teddy's birthday, we took the train down to New York. As we entered the magnificent lobby of the Eisner Theater, I was in good spirits, saying to Teddy, "The size of this stage will make that little stage I built you behind the garage look pathetic." When suddenly we were stopped by a stern young fellow, a Mr. Ernesti, I believe, who said, "We're sorry, sir, but you cannot be admitted on merely a promissory voucher. Are you kidding us? You must take your voucher and your proof of purchases from at least 6 of our major artistic sponsors, such as AOL, such as Coke, and go at once to the Redemption Center on 44th and Broadway to get your real actual tickets. And please do not be late, as latecomers cannot be admitted due to special effects which occur early, which require total darkness in order to simulate the African jungle at night." Well, this was news to me, but I was not about to disappoint the boy. We left the Eisner and started up Broadway, the Everly readers in the sidewalk reading the Everly strips in our shoes, the building-mounted mini-screens at eye level showing images reflective of the personal preferences we'd stated on our monthly Everly preference worksheets, the numerous Cybex sudden emergence screens out-thrusting or down-thrusting inches from our faces. And in addition, I could very clearly hear the sound-only messages being beamed to me and me alone via various Casio oral focusers, such as one that shouted out to me between 42nd and 43rd, "Mr. Petrillo, you chose Burger King's 8 times last fiscal year, but only 2 times thus far this fiscal year. Please do not forsake us now. There's a store 1 block north." In the voice of Broadway star Elaine Weston, while at 43rd, a light pole-mounted focuser shouted, "Golly, Leonard, remember your childhood on the farm in Oneonta? Why not reclaim those roots with a Starbucks country roast?" In a celebrity rural voice I could not identify, possibly Buck Owens. And then, best of all, in the doorway of PLC Electronics, a life-size Gene Kelly hologram suddenly appeared, tap dancing, saying, "Leonard, my data indicates you're a bit of an old-timer like myself." Gosh, in our day, life was simpler, wasn't it, Leonard? Why not come in and let Frankie Z explain the latest gizmos? And he looked so real, and I called out to Teddy, "Teddy, look there. Gene Kelly, do you remember I mentioned him to you as one of the all-time greats?" But Teddy, of course, did not see Gene Kelly not being one of his preferences. but instead saw his hero, Babar, swinging a small monkey on his trunk while saying that his data indicated that Teddy did not yet own a Nintendo. So that was fun. That was very New York. But what was not so fun was, by the time we got through the line at the Redemption Center, it was 10 minutes until showtime, and my feet had swollen up the way they do shortly before they begin spontaneously bleeding, which they have done ever since a winter spent in the freezing muck of Chiang Mai, Korea. It's something I have learned to live with. If I can sit, that is helpful. If I can lean against something, also good. Best of all, if I can take my shoes off, which I did, leaning against the wall. All around and above us were those towering walls of light, curving across building fronts, embedded in the sidewalks, custom fitted to light poles. A cartoon lion eating a man in a suit. A rain of gold coins falling into the canoe of a naked rainforest family. A woman in lingerie running a bottle of Pepsi between her breasts. The Merrill Lynch talking Fisk asking, "Are you kicking ass or kissing it?" A perfect human rear dancing. A fake flock of geese turning into a field of Bebe logos. A dying grandmother's room filled with roses by a FedEx man who then holds up a card saying, "No charge." And standing beneath all that bounty was our little Teddy, tiny and sad, whose grandfather could not even manage to get him into one crummy show. So I said to myself, "Get off the wall, old man, blood or no blood. Just keep the legs moving, and soon enough you'll be there." And off we went, me hobbling, Teddy holding my arm, making decent time, and I think we would have made the curtain, except suddenly there appeared a citizen helper who asked, "Were we from out of town? And was that why, via removing my shoes, I had caused my Everly strips to be rendered inoperative?" I should say here that I'm no stranger to innovative approaches to advertising, having pioneered the use of towable signboards in Oneonta back in the Nixon years, when I towed a fleet of 30 around town with a Dodge Dart, wearing a suit that today would be found comic. By which I mean I have no problem with the concept of the Everly strip. That is not why I had my shoes off. I am as patriotic as the next guy. Rather, as I have said, it was due to my bleeding feet. I told all this to the citizen helper, who asked if I was aware that, by rendering my strips inoperative, I was sacrificing a terrific opportunity to celebrate my preferences. And I said, "Yes, yes, I regretted this very much." He said he was sorry about my feet, he himself having a trick elbow, and that he would be happy to forget this unfortunate incident if I would only put my shoes back on and complete the rest of my walk extremely slowly, looking energetically to both left and right, so that the higher density of messages thus received would compensate for those I had missed. And I admit I was a little short with that helper and said, "Young man, these dark patches on my socks are blood. Do you or do you not see them?" Which was when his face changed. And he said, "Please do not snap at me, sir. I hope you are aware of the fact that I can write you up." And then I made a mistake. Because as I looked at that citizen helper, his round face, his pale sideburns, the way his feet turned in, it seemed to me that I knew him. Or rather, it seemed that he could not be so very different from me when I was a young man. Not so different from the friends of my youth, from Jeffy DeSoto, say, who once fought a Lithuanian gang that had stuck an M80 up the ass of a cat, or from Ken Larmer, who had such a sweet tenor voice and died stifling a laugh in the hills above Khoi Jang. I brought out a 20 and, leaning over, said, "Look, please. The kid just really wants to see this show." Which is when he pulled out his pad and began to write. Now, even being from Oneonta, I knew that being written up does not take 1 or 2 minutes. We would be standing there at least half an hour, after which we would have to go to an active complaints center where they would check our strips for operability and make us watch that corrective video called Robust Economy, Super Moral Climate, which I had already been made to watch 3 times last winter when I was out of work and we could not afford cable. And we would totally miss Babar Singh's. Please, I said, please. We have seen plenty of personalized messages via both the building-mounted mini-screens at eye level and those suddenly out-thrusting Cybek emergent screens. We have learned plenty for one day. Honest to God, we have. And he said, sir, since when do you make the call as far as when you have received enough useful information from our artistic partners? And just kept writing me up. Well, there I was, in my socks. There was Teddy, with a scared look in his eyes that I haven't seen since his toddler days, when he had such a fear of chickens that we could never buy Rosemont eggs due to the cartoon chicken on the carton. Or if we did, had to first cut the chicken off with scissors we kept in the car for that purpose. So I made a quick decision and seized that citizen helper's ticket pack and flung it into the street, shouting at Teddy, run, run! And run he did, and run I did. And while that citizen helper floundered in the street, torn between chasing us and retrieving his pad, we raced down Broadway, and glancing back over my shoulder, I saw a hulking young man stick out his foot, and down that helper went, and soon I was handing our tickets to the same stern Mr. Ernesti, who was now less stern, and in we went and took our seats as stars appeared overhead and the Eisner was transformed into a nighttime jungle. And suddenly there was Babar, looking with longing toward Paris, where the old lady was saying that she had dreamed of someone named Babar, and did any of us know who this Babar was and where he might be found? And Teddy knew the answer from the original cast CD, which was, Babar is within us, in all of our hearts. And he shouted it out with all of the other children as the old lady began singing, The King Inside of You. And let me tell you, from that moment, everything changed for Teddy. I'm happy to report he has joined the play at school. He wears a scarf everywhere he goes, throwing it over his shoulder with what can only be described as bravado, and says, whenever asked, that he has decided to become an actor. This from a boy too timid to trick or treat. This from the boy we once found walking home from school in tears, padlocked to his own bike. There are no more late night crying episodes. He no longer writes on his arms with permanent marker. He leaps out of bed in the morning, anxious to get to school, and dons his scarf, and is already sitting at the table eating breakfast when we come down. The other day as he got off the bus, I heard him say to his bus driver, cool as a cucumber, see you at the Oscars. When an Everly reader is reading, and then it suddenly stops, it is not hard to trace. And within a week, I received a certified letter setting my fine at $1,000 and stating that in lieu of the fine, I could elect to return to the originating location of my infraction. They included a map. And under the supervision of that citizen helper, retrace my steps, shoes on, thus reclaiming a significant opportunity to celebrate my preferences. This, to me, is not America. What America is to me is a guy doesn't want to buy, you let him not buy. You respect his not buying. A guy has a crazy notion different from your crazy notion, you pat him on the back and say, hey, pal, nice crazy notion, let's go have a beer. America, to me, should be shouting all the time. A bunch of shouting voices. Most of them wrong, some of them nuts, but please, not just one droning, glamorous, reasonable voice. but do the math. A day's pay, plus train ticket, plus meals, plus taxis to avoid the bleeding feet. Still, that is less than 1,000. So down I went. That citizen helper, whose name was Rob, said he was glad about my change of heart. Every time a voice shot into my ear telling me things about myself I already knew, every time a celebrity hologram walked up like an old friend, Rob checked a box on my infraction correction form and said, "Isn't that amazing, Mr. Petrillo, that we can do that? That we can know you so well that we can help you identify the things you want and need?" And I would say, "Yes, Rob, that is amazing." Sick in the gut, but trying to keep my mind on the $500 I was saving and all the dance classes that would buy. And as for Teddy, as I write this, it is nearly midnight, and he is tapping in the room above. He looks like a bird, our boy. He watches the same musical 15 times in a row. Walking through the mall, he suddenly emits a random line of dialogue and lunges off to the side, doing a dance step that resembles a stumble, spilling his drink, plowing into a group of incredulous, snickering Oneontans. He looks like no one else, acts like no one else. His clothes are increasingly like plumage. Late at night, he choreographs using plastic army men. He fits no mold and has no friends. But I believe in my heart that someday something beautiful may come from him.
We've heard My Flamboyant Grandson by George Saunders as it was read by Harris Yulin. Selected Shorts is produced by Catherine Minton and directed by Isaiah Sheffer. The executive director of Symphony Space is Cynthia Elliott. Our radio producer is Sarah Montague. The readings are recorded by Miles B. Smith, and our mix engineer is Stu Kennedy. Major support for Selected Shorts is provided by Houghton Mifflin, publishers of the Best American Short Stories, edited in 2007 by Stephen King, and by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873, and on the web at bn.com. Additional support is given by the Dungannon Foundation, sponsor of the Ray Award for the Short Story, the Lila Acheson Wallace Theater Fund in the New York Community Trust, the Henry Nias Foundation, the Axe Houghton Foundation, the Arthur Foundation, and members of the Symphony Space Literature Producers Circle. Public funds come from the National Endowment for the Arts, which believes a great nation deserves great art, and the New York State Council on the Arts, a state agency. Selected Shorts is a co-production of Symphony Space and WNYC Radio in New York and is distributed nationwide by PRI, Public Radio International.
Support for this program comes from this station and Public Radio International stations nationwide and is made possible in part by the PRI Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
PRI, Public Radio International.